The Utah Open Source Foundation brings the Utah Lugs home. Feel free to listen live at stream.utos.org or catch the audio afterward at podcast.utos.org. The bandwidth is provided by Tier 4. The following presentation, using GPS on Linux with GPS Babel, GPIC Sync, and Google Earth, was given on January 21, 2009 by Mark Christensen at the Salt Lake Linux Users Group. Visit their site at slug.org.
There's three tools that I want to talk about tonight. One is called GPS Babel, and the other one is GPIC Sync, and the other one is Google Earth. And most of you are familiar with Google Earth. It's this program here that allows you to investigate and learn about the world around you. And it's just one of the funnest programs I've ever found on Linux. And with 3D... you can zoom right in, and we're right around here somewhere. And with 3D, you get the terrain, 3D terrain. If you turn on 3D buildings, you can get those too. If it decides to download them. Oh, yeah, a lot of these buildings, well, there's a few buildings that have been modeled in 3D downtown. I think this is supposed to be one of them. Yeah. Anyway, it's not downloading the 3D data, but that's cool. That's not the point. One of the new features in the latest Google Earth for Linux is that it'll import a GPX file. And I actually had my GPS running all the way down here from, I live in Utah County, and I took a few pictures along the way. Now, unfortunately, I didn't bring my card reader, the one that I need for this camera. And so we're not going to be able to use this data. Let's see. Right about my GPS, and we can look at at how to get data off the GPS. Now, this is the GPS I have, and there are several brands and manufacturers and models out there. There are several features that I like about this. And this is a Garmin Vista HCX. It's a high-sensitivity receiver. So it doesn't really have to be out in plain view of the sky like this to get a good reading. I take this with me skiing all the time, and I just put it in my backpack, and it's at the top of the backpack, but it tracks where I go all day, through the whole day, all the runs that I do when I'm snowboarding. And let me see if I can pull one of those up here. Now, I have a Facebook account. I have some photos on there. I think that's the account I used. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so here's a day at Solitude. Here's a day at Park City. It's yellow, so it's not as easy to see. Here's a couple days at Sundance. This one's easier to see because the line is dark. But it's everywhere I went that day at Sundance. And it's pulled into Google Earth. So this is just a GPX file that's been pulled in straight to Google Earth. So let's see if we can do that with this GPS here. So one of the nice things I like about this GPS is that it has support for a microSD card in its battery compartment, and with a setting that you set, says not only do I want you to store it in your native format on the GPS, but I also want you to store my track in a GPX format on the card. And it's an open format. GPX is an open standard. Okay, so there's the logs for every day that I've had my GPS turned on. And we can take today's, just drop it out here. Now, there's actually a problem with the GPX format that Garmin writes to their card. For some reason, Google Earth won't import it directly. So that brings us to our first tool that we're going to be using to analyze this track. Now, if I go to Google Earth here and File, Open, GPX, and we see that right there. I click open. Oh, maybe, you know, it might have opened it up. Let's see. It did. Okay, so maybe in the latest version they fixed it. Okay, so what I've had to do in the past is that Google Earth wouldn't open up this file format. There was some inconsistency with the standard, or maybe it wasn't pure XML or something like that. So GPS Babel will talk directly to GPSs and transmit data from the GPS, or it'll take any type of most GPS format, native format files, and convert them to any other format. So if you have, say, a KMZ file or KML file from Google Earth, but you want to use it in your MapSource program from Garmin, or in Topo from National Geographic or something like that, you can convert between the formats. You can do really cool things like change the line width, the color, whether the line is clamped to the ground or elevated off the ground. I have a friend that's a pilot, and he goes flying, and when he imports his track into Google Earth, it's clamped to the ground, when in reality he was at 2,000 feet or so. So he can elevate the track and say, show it to me above the Earth and where I was actually flying. You can actually do that here manually. You can right-click on, you can go over here and properties, and then you can say altitude. You can set it here as well. And if you look here, it's actually elevated off the ground, and you can change that to whatever you want. But as I was driving, I was pretty much clamped to the ground. Yeah. Okay, so this is the track that I took getting down here. From right where I live, here in Orem, drove down I-15 around Point of the Mountain, around I-215, around here to the U. And what I really wanted to do was take this other program and create a KMZ file for you that would match up the track that I just did with the pictures that I took, but I don't have a card reader. So I don't know if anybody came in late, if you have a XD card reader.
Let's run a Best Buy real quick.
Yeah. That's okay. I've actually got a data set already that I created with a friend last year when we were skiing up at Sundance. And it contains pictures as well as the track log and everything like that. So we can go play with that.
XD, is that the really small ones?
Yeah, from Panasonic, or Olympus makes them. There's SD, which is the micro SD. And
yeah. There's
the micro SD. This is different, yeah. And I actually have a multi, you know, format card reader, but it's at home. So not going to help us out today. Okay, I think this is all transferred. Okay, great. So in here we have the... I wonder if the... doesn't look like the original... Well, there it is. So let me get that. So when it says, so there's two in here. There's the original one, and then it should be getting the processed one as well. Okay, so the processed one is basically the converted version, the one that I knew would work in Google Earth. So let's go ahead and take a look at that. Can everybody see it? Okay. So now you can see everywhere that me and my friend went.
So what if two of you had like two different GPS data, like you went both on snowboarding and then one of you went different paths and that sort of thing? Mm-hmm. Could you do like import both of the data on the same map and then colorize them?
Well, okay, so the way that the tool works, it only takes one GPX file is an argument. But it's valid XML data, right?
So you could put both of them together.
Well, the thing is that it defines two different paths, right? And so there's a way to have multiple paths in a GPX file, but I believe because I believe that you can take a map that has multiple paths on it, multiple tracks, and save it out as a single GPX file. So there's got to be a way to have two, more than one GPX file in there. The only ones that I'm familiar with are coming from a single GPS, and they're all sequential in time, and so there's no overlap. But you would be dealing with timestamps that were similar, so you couldn't just merge the two because it would go by date, and it wouldn't know the difference between the two data points. Okay, so let's take this, and we'll take this track, and we'll take the photos that I have, and create a KMZ file, which is Google Map and Google Earth native file format. Well, I'll show you quickly what GPS Babel can do by just looking at the help. So you have your in file type, out file type, it filters, and as far as filters, here's the formats it'll take. It'll take, these are all the different types of formats that it convert to and from. It'll go either way on all of these. So it has CSV, let's see, there's a Palm OS native format, it looks like, XMAP, Easy GPS, which is a free GPS waypoint management tool. It'll do the LOC files from geocaching.org or geocaching.com. MapSource, which is Garmin's program. It'll also talk Garmin protocol directly to talk to Garmin GPSs. It'll talk directly to Magellan GPSs and so on. You can see it's fairly extensive in what it can do. But you can also do other filters, like say, I want out of all this data in this GPX file, I want all points within a certain radius or outside of a certain radius or within a certain time range before this and after this or, you know, so on. You can do a lot of manipulation of them, of the data points. Uses Google, let's see, GPS Drive, which is the open source GPS navigation. GPX, which is the open source or the open format for GPS exchange. So there's all these different formats of data that you can exchange between. It's really helpful. So if you're ever in a bind and you have a data set from a GPS or some mapping program, most likely you can use this program to change it into something you can use. There's been a GUI for this a long time for Windows, and just recently with the latest release, there's also a GUI for Linux now. Okay, so the tool that I want to use here is called GPixSync. There's a GUI and a command line version of this. And I actually packaged this up and put it in the OpenSUSE build service, and it's available for a bunch of different operating systems. I can't remember which ones it's actually building correctly on, but it's just a Python file. It doesn't really need compiling, and so more or less it's, you know, you have to set up the dependencies that the RPM needs for each different distro, because sometimes they have different package names, and then file locations may be different amongst the different distros and so. So go search for it in the OpenSUSE build service. There's an RPM. It's old, and there's a couple bugs logged against it that I need to fix, mostly with file locations and things like that. But for the most part, it's going to work. So we can choose the picture folder that we want to work with. It looks like it's defaulting to where we are right now, so we can select OK for that. And the GPX file, we're going to choose that one. And icons, we want a picture thumbnail. We want the elevation to be clamped to the ground. And what it says with timestamp, that's okay. And then the Google Earth's export folder, let's make this, you know, I can't remember if this is relative to the other one, but I think it is. So we'll just put in Google Earth. Now, if you click interpolation or interpol, if your GPS track has a long time between two points and a picture appears with a timestamp in between those points, this will interpolate and find out, well, you know, looking at your data here, you probably would have been in this location. It'll help you locate your pictures a little bit closer where they should have been if there's a big discrepancy. Backup pictures, add geonames and geotags. I've never done that before, but it'll add it into the HTML metadata, or it might put it in a picture, in with the picture or the HTML stuff. Now, if you were out taking pictures, and then you get home and you say, oh, man, I didn't change my GPS or my camera for the for the time change or something like that, and you're an hour off or something, you can go in here and say, I was actually 55 minutes off, or I was, you know, 30 minutes off, so adjust that when you're syncing up pictures. Okay, so let's see if, I can't remember if I had to save settings first or not, but we'll see. Okay, let's see. Didn't geocode. And I might have been off, so we can try. Oh, you know what? I might have to actually. It might be UTC versus, so let's say. What's 7 hours in seconds?
25,200.
Well, let's see if it'll do it by hours first. No, it's not going to do it. So, what was it again?
25,200.
Okay, so it's found a picture and it's geotagging it now. So,
I guess why that's important?
Yeah. Okay, so.
I heard you say why it was important to have it lined up for time. Is that just so you can tell where you were along the path?
Yeah. Well, it needs to know where you were. So it needs to take. The timestamp of the photo and match it up with the closest timestamp in the trail, in the GPS track. And if they're off, it's not going to match up. So it's hanging here, and I don't know why. And it could be that I don't have the time right. Either way, it's... It works. It's just that I don't have the settings here. But luckily, I think that when I transferred the data set, I actually had already done this once. So we can take a look at what we've got here. Yeah, okay. So here's a... let's see. I hope it didn't override it. It might have. Yeah. Let me copy the Okay. So what this does is it gives you two documents when it's done syncing this up. It will mark all of your photos with the right time or put all the locations from the track into the photos for you, and it'll put them into a directory. I believe it's into Thumbs. It might be actually in here. And then it'll back up the originals into a separate directory for you. So it'll modify the metadata and put the GPS location in each photo for you, and it'll create these two files. doc.kml and docweb.kml, and they're two different files. The doc.kml can be used directly on Google Earth, and the docweb can be placed on a server. So what you want to do is you take this whole directory as is and zip it up, or for your friends on Windows, or tar it up for your friends on Linux, and just send it to them, or place it on a web server and say, hey, grab this file, unzip it or untar it, and then open this file up in Google Earth. Okay, or you can also do something like this. And create an index file. And what you do is you take your doc-web.kml file and all the graphics and all the thumbs, this thumb directory, as is, tar it up and put that onto a web server and untar it. So it's out there in a directory. And then what you can do is take this and the URL to the doc.kml file out there on the web and put that into Google Earth as an argument for Google Earth in the location area. And Google Earth, well, let's pull that, or not, I'm not, sorry, not Google Earth, but Google Maps. So let me find out where this is first. Okay, so this is that directory we were just looking at, on my local machine, but on my web server. And you'll see here that it contains the index.html and the docweb and doc.kml. And if we take this URL here to this docweb, which is in this directory here, now, Google Earth actually goes out and retrieves this KML file from my server and creates a mashup for you. So now you can see my track, which is contained inside the KML file. And if we zoom in here, you see that when I created it, before when we were using the GUI, I said use the icon, the pictures for the icon. This example here is using the little camera icon instead of a thumbnail for the icon. But now I can click on each of these, and it'll actually open up the picture. Now I've noticed that the first time you open it up, it doesn't really draw the box very well. But now you can see that picture was taken at exactly that spot. I did. So what happens is when you turn off your GPS and then drive to another location, turn it back on, it creates a new data point. Well, the next one was, you know, a straight line 50 miles away or whatever. So you can see here we are in Bishop's Bowl, and here we are up at Bear Claw Cabin, I believe. Looking down on Provo Valley. And here's some other friends that we were with. And if you click on the actual picture, it will then fetch the full size one for you in a different browser window. And there I am with my sweaty hair after having boarded most of the day. You know, for some reason, it doesn't catch the decorations right, and so you have to click on a couple times before you get the decorations to show up right. So anyway, that's what you can do with the KML file. You can also, so this is how you can use the doc web one. You just upload it to a directory, and then you can point your friends to it and say, hey, here are our family vacation photos in Yellowstone. And you see everywhere you went in Yellowstone, and along the way, look at all the pictures you took. If you open up the regular doc file, but in Google Earth, you get this here. So this is the one, this is just importing the GPX file. The difference is that when you open up the KML file, wonder if we're going to have problems opening that up. We can open the doc one, the web one, and see if that works. Well, I don't know why that's not working.
Did you move it from a different relative location?
It's relative to the directory that it's in, so it shouldn't matter. Yeah, I copied that directory and all the lower ones intact. So it should open up, but it's not for some reason. It's kind of weird. And it could be that, you know, they were made for an older version of Google Earth, which is the case. I think I made it with Google Earth like 3 something or other, and so it may not work. But let's see. Let's see if this works. There we go. I hadn't. So when I recopied them from my server, I put them in my home directory instead of the actual one that I was trying to overwrite. Okay, so now we're in Google Earth looking at the same picture or the same track that we were before. In fact, let's turn off the other one. Turn those off. So now we've just got the one that we just loaded up fresh. Okay, so now we have a much better representation of where we went. With the 3D, you get a much better feel of what path we went on, and you can click on here and you'll get a picture. It'll actually pull up the picture. I think for some reason it takes a lot longer when you do this. I think it's actually pulling up the full size of them and then scaling it down.
That track looks like it comes down through the trees. Is that actually your real track?
Over here?
No, to the down. See, the 190084 JPEG.
84 right here.
Yeah, and so going down and to the left, and that just looked like it went through the trees. I was wondering if you had that kind of a dip.
Actually, we did. This is actually supposed to be down here, I believe, right below those trees there. Well, you know what? I may have done that. Yeah, I did. This is right where the lift is.
Right, no, but I was looking at the one that kind of came down to the trees, and there's another one. If you rotate, down that way, see what comes over the shoulder of the mountain?
Oh, right over here?
Nope, down, follow the 219084 down to the left.
Oh, right down through here?
Yeah.
Oh, no, this is another lift.
Oh, it's not the lift.
Yeah. But, I didn't do this on this day, but right down through these trees right here is just awesome. Nobody really hits that area. It's usually 4 feet of powder on powder days all day long. So I usually hit this area right here, and right over here, So this is a run called Snowstake, right down through here, actually. And right down through here in these trees is a hidden run that's not on the trail maps. It's called Regulator Manson. And you go down in there, and it actually has a trail sign on one of the trees, but it's not on any of the maps. It's kind of cool. And all of these right down here are all double blacks, and those are really fun on good snow days. They go down, they get really steep down toward the bottom. I think they go over 45 degrees. Most, like up here on the upper slope, this is all 45 degrees up here. But just right down here before you drop into the chute, they go a lot steeper. So probably close to 50 degrees just before you drop in. And I really hate those runs on when it's hard packed or when it hasn't snowed for a while, but on a good 2-foot powder day, awesome. Just amazing. So anyway, that's basically what I wanted to talk tonight about. So I don't know if you guys have any questions or...
Is there documentation on any of this stuff?
Uh-huh. There's documentation for Google Earth. It's they don't really talk about importing GPX files, but it's as simple as opening one up. That works fine. GPS Babel has really good documentation on its website. So we can just actually go to the website. GPS Babel, and it has really good documentation right on its site somewhere. Docs, right there. Formats, all these different formats are supported. There's a tips and tricks thing too, I thought, somewhere around here. How was it? Tips, right there. So tips for geocachers. There's even a way to like set up a script or something that you can set up as a MIME type for your browser, so that when you hit an LOC file, download an LOC file from geocaching.com, you can automatically transfer your GPS and do some things like that. So it's pretty cool. Hey, Jim. Let's see, VFAC. It's a pretty powerful program. It'll talk to most GPSs out there in some format or another. Some of the newer GPSs, it may not, or the specialized GPSs, it may not talk all the protocols. Like, for example, the Garmin that I use for my bike computer will do other things like heart rate. It'll record the heart rate and other things like that. And I think this actually does it, but newer GPSs that come out with features that are specialized for that, it may not include all the features for those. Like, there are specific GPSs just for aircraft usage. There's specific GPSs just for paragliding, hang gliding. There are specific GPSs that are just for fishing, and it may not handle all of the extra data sets or whatever it may record for those things. But for the most part, I found it extremely usable and able to convert any data that I've had to use. So Google Earth is located at earth.google.com. And it's closed source, but it's free, so you can just download it, install it. They have Windows, Mac, and Linux versions. The interesting thing, tie-in with this with Google SketchUp, is that Google SketchUp is the main modeling tool that they use to create the 3D objects that are in Google Earth. So if you're browsing around Google Earth and you see a 3D building or bench or whatever has been modeled and placed somewhere in Google Earth, it was designed or built up using SketchUp. Or at least exported using SketchUp, because they could have designed it in, I don't know, AutoCAD, and imported the DXF file into SketchUp. And then GPixSync. GPIC Sync is the other program we were using. And I think I've got the most recent version in that I build as an RPM in the OpenSUSE build service. But it still has some bugs and things that I need to work out as far as packaging goes. And maybe a patch or two that I need to apply to it. But this is what it'll do. Here's the interface that we were looking at. And it'll actually show you, say, show me my current files that I've tagged in Google Earth, and it'll actually pull up Google Earth for you. So here's what it looks like when it actually works. You can see here it says found image and writing latitude, longitude to the image and so on. And then here's what we were just looking at. So, any other questions? Cool. You know, we didn't talk about what was new in Linux. So we actually haven't met for a couple months. Actually, we went to a talk in December. So I think the last time we actually met was in November, I think. So there's been a bit that's gone on. Anybody know? Yeah.
Paul Pree was announced at CES.
Oh, what was?
The Palm Pre, it's the new replacement for smartphones.
Now, is that the Linux-based OS?
Yeah, that's the one we've been waiting for.
Forever?
Yeah, for years.
And they were, I guess there's been a lot of excitement about it over it.
Yeah, their stock's up 35%.
Wow, that's cool.
In something, in other words?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't know it was based on Linux. I thought it was still Palm OS.
No, well, they... you don't read a lot about it, but it's Linux under the hood, but they call it WebOS. And basically the concept is that it's going to be called HTML technology, more or less. It's basically anything that somebody writes from the web these days using Ajax and some of those kinds of things, you know, should be very easy to port over to WebOS.
And
yeah.
I wonder if they have an SDK that they're going to be coming out like everybody else is doing.
They do. It's all kind of pre-release at this point in time. They had some prototypes that they put in reporters' hands and very quickly took them back again.
Well, that tends to be more now. I mean, I was considering moving over to T-Mobile with Google phones.
Yeah.
And I'm a great customer, so that actually makes it easy for me to try it out. So.
Well, when it actually hits, I mean, it's kind of in the realm of vaporware at this point, but they have at least officially announced it, but it's going to be a Sprint exclusive for a while. So
Verizon users
like me have to wait.
They have me for 7 months, and then I can decide to go to like T-Mobile or whatever. So if it comes out between now and then, I'll let them just go to the Google phone.
They were saying something about it's going to have support through multitasking, which the other smartphones like the Google phone and Palm OS don't do right now yet.
It'll support what?
True multitasking as far as apps and things, right? Yeah. I actually wrote down a few things. I perused Linux Weekly News. Oh, Alan Cox is leaving Red Hat.
Where's going?
Intel. The 2.628 kernel was released, and
nobody's using it yet.
But the one that I'm more excited about is the 2.629 kernel, which has the
I've heard ops stuff.
It's a new file system.
So your current kernel doesn't have any KVM or Zen components in it. They were supposed to backport them in, and they've been waiting forever.
Well, yeah.
I mean, they're there, but they don't work. Like, put our example
for the 2.627
kernel,
and
it broke.
Hmm.
Like, I can't use
Zen, and
this is me off.
Oh.
So I'm excited about that one as well.
There's also, BTRFS support using that new kernel.
I was at FedCon a couple weeks ago, and they were talking about BTRFS and the transition between how they're going to use EHT4 as a transition point to BTRFS. And it looks like it's going to be really cool.
Yeah.
Popping on the right class is super awesome. They're working on the final project.
Yeah. AMD released open source drivers for their ATI R600, R700.
Oh,
chipsets.
Why
finally? Well, they've been closed source for a long time and holding back.
The kernel developers love everybody to release everything open source.
Yeah.
Now we don't want them. They always have some reason for why they're going to stay open source.
And I think that once AMD was... Well, the nice thing is that, you know, the same problems I had with the laptop setting up for the Google SketchUp was that AMD drivers on Linux just haven't been very good. I've always had problems with them, but I've had a lot fewer problems and had better success with NVIDIA. And especially with 3D applications, NVIDIA's had better support for a long time. So maybe that'll change with them open sourcing that. SCO is aiming to sell off its assets. Apparently there isn't. I don't know.
I just wonder if that's news.
Yeah, I don't think it is.
Do they still have any assets?
They have their mobile division, but, I mean, what did they ever do with that anyway?
How do I buy in?
Yeah. Aside from shares. Let's see. Chrome 2.0 from Google is supposed to be released for Linux shortly. And I think they even came out with a deadline, but I don't know what it is. One of the biggest things that's happened within, I think it was last week or the week before, is that Qt has been announced that version 4.5 will be released under LGPL. Yeah, so now there's no barriers at all.
So the Qt, Qt license and GPL, you couldn't link two shared libraries, whatever the browser device.
Right, without releasing your code as GPL as well.
Can it go retroactively?
No, it's going to be from version 4.5 on. So with that release forward, it'll be LGPL. And one of the big reasons behind it, what they're saying, is that Nokia bought Qt, or Trolltech. And Nokia is not a GUI company, right? They're more interested in getting that out as a standard and getting it in wide use. And so they're doing away with using Qt as a business model and using it as a tool to deploy on. And RHEL 5.3 was just announced, I think, today or yesterday.
I did not know that.
Yeah. RHEL 5, Red Hat Enterprise Linux 5.3. Yeah. Right. Oh, cool. Yeah, that'll be really fun. Yeah. Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
That's cool.
Well, it's what do they call it? The e-learning stuff, which is they give credit for it, but it's like an elective credit, and so they use it in CS degrees, but you take it as non-credit classes too. So
cool.
I'm excited to be back teaching because I was like Jones and to go out and share the gospel with one another.
Yeah.
So related to sharing the gospel, there's the Salt Lake Linux Day.
Mm-hmm. It's 28th?
It's Wednesday at 1, I think.
And where's that located? Do you have any details?
I got it.
Marriott
downtown. It's at 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Novell's sponsoring it. So they're the ones driving it. I talked to the guy about it a little bit and asked him about other distributions and that sort of thing that really sort of fits an OpenSUSE event. But there are, you know, it's cool. Distribution agnostic things like Xen and KVM that they really talked about. Since it's the new hot mess and some of the other things. I think they were talking about NOAA as well. I don't remember all the details, but when he sent it to you, and if you guys didn't get it, Slug has it in an endless, and there's an HTML doc that goes with it. He covers all of it. It's really quite nice. And they wrote it up well, so.
I think I tried to open that up, but it didn't come out right in my browser.
Yeah. When I sent it out to the Utah Open Source attendees list, people said that they didn't get it in the the attachment, although I know the attachment's there. So I wonder if they have it on their website.
Slug or?
No, they have it on their website.
I'm pretty sure they do.
Yeah, you probably serve no doubt in the day to find it. We can click the phone.
Anything else new in Linux over the last little while? Closing up shop.
Yeah, so their prices are like average prices now instead of really expensive.
10% off on really serious.
Yes,
stuff.
So I had a friend go over there actually. He said that nothing is that discounted. So
pass.
The thing is, they have to pay their their sellers and people, so that'll keep them in stock.
Yeah, I stopped by there because I'm trying to fix my home theater stuff. There you go.
Okay, did you get anything decent?
Nope.
No? Same
answer? Well, there wasn't a lot of good deals there yet. And the thing is that, once firms like that, when they go out of business, they hire a clearance firm, right?
Yeah.
And they usually don't really do a good job of marking down prices all day. They say 30 to 70% off. And you go in there and say, everything I don't want is 70% off. What's up with that? Yeah. So everything that's trashy is a loss leader, and anything that's really wanted is normal price. So.
I got a question for the group.
Yeah.
With Circuit City going out and so forth, it seems like all the stuff that I used to buy motherboards and chips and all the competitive computers are pretty much gone the way of all flesh now. Are there any left that anybody is using to recommend?
PC Club is gone.
There was a store in Murray, and I thought it was open last week. Someone said,
PC Club.
Yeah, but it's a funny story that you should mention this, because I go to the CTO breakfast down in Provo once a month, and the CTO breakfast, there's a gentleman by the name of Scott Lemon. I don't know if any of you know who he is, but he's kind of more of a marketing guru kind of guy that does a lot of tech. And so his big thing right now is to get everybody to send an email or fill out a form for Fry's to come to us.
Yes.
Fry's would be awesome.
If you're seriously interested in that, you want to go to their site, and they have a comment form and request it. And the more that we can get to request it, then they'll have it. There's also a store called Micro Center, which is out in the East Coast, mostly, that I would love to have come here as well. So there's two options for that.
Well, we just need somebody to buy a franchise.
I don't think that's
going to
be the case, because they're both corporate owned.
I think, fries are all corporate owned.
But we've got IKEA here, so we've got to have big enough community to buy computers now.
Yeah, there's no real...
The largest tech companies out there.
Right.
I went to... Where was it? There's EBC and Orem. I've never had really good luck with them. Their return policies are difficult. MAS Computers is fairly pricey, but they're decent. Well, USI Computers is pretty good. It's on 33rd and.
They don't have
motherboards. I haven't seen.
Have you seen the domestic?
No, where's that
shop? It's just south of the mall there, just off state.
Okay, there's also one. You know the name of it, but it's on 45th South, right next to the McDonald's there off the freeway. And it's hidden kind of. They have a coffee shop in there. So they have a coffee shop, and while you're waiting for your computer to get fixed, you can have coffee. It's kind of interesting. Yep. But they also sell lots of parts, and I've been meaning to go in there for a long time.
There's a place called Software More. It's about 45th South and 20th East, and thereabouts.
Getting corner to the former Cottonwood Mall.
Yes.
I haven't been there for years.
They've been there for a long time.
Where is it? There's a place where? EBC. I've not really had good luck with.
So
is there one here? I'm trying to think of the place that I
I think they do have.
It used to be an EBC, but I haven't seen it in a while.
Yeah.
So the thing about EBC is, like, they have everything you ever wanted in there, but their salesmen are jerks. I mean, that's what it comes down to. Like, they don't want to treat you nice. And they think that's your, like,
well,
they have tons of stuff.
Their return policies have always been bothersome.
Yeah,
the other thing with MOS computers or MAS computers is that you can buy anything you want there, but you can never get cash back. You can only get store credit. And that's been an issue with me, too, with them. I mean, I don't mind buying from them, but if something doesn't work or it's not going to be what I need, I want to be able to get my money back. Oh, yeah. Seagate. Yeah, that was the... there's a couple firmware versions, or a few drive models that have bad firmware that you need to update your firmware if you want it to live. They die after a little while.
But what is it?
Some Seagate drives that have bad firmware. But you can... I think so.
Yeah. The solution to that is just by Western Digital.
Although
That was argued on the list, too.
Although I have always been impressed with the Seagate versions that have the 5-year warranties, that they seem to be pretty decent.
Well, and there's other drivers that are good. Hitachi's got really good ones.
Yeah.
And the next team, is it Samsung? No, it's not Samsung. It's the other one. Toshiba? Yeah, that's good. But they're a little more expensive usually.
Well, the Seagate issue is really not broad.
No, there's only a few models.
So I've heard that from lots of people, like all their TV drives have problems. Like they go, they're out of warranty and wrapped out of warranty. Is like this.
I think
there's in a business community that's like, you know, you can replace them anyway, but as a consumer drop.
Well, you know, I've never had problems with my Seagate drives, but I always buy the 5-year warranty ones, and I never try to get anything less than that if I can, and then another big thing is cooling. I've had drives go bad that were in an enclosure, properly installed with a lot of room around them, but heat just kills drives. And so what I've done now is I've taken the drive panels off of the front drives and replaced it with a plate of aluminum with two fans in there that I just mounted, drilled some holes and mounted them in there. And so I check the drive temperature in there, never above 27, 28 degrees Celsius instead of the 39 to 50 degrees that they were before. So, and that's helped my drives stay alive a lot longer.
Is that an add-on of your cell
phone? I'll put some pictures. You can make it. Who did?
Well, my proper child laid off for what half their staff. How much?
40%. Yeah. Move Networks did too. About the same amount. Yeah. So, you know, the tech industry in Utah has been fairly good, but
there are jobs out there. I will attest to that because I've actually had two job offers in the last 2 months.
Yeah.
And I'm starting a new job in 2 weeks. So, in fact, Daniel's my recruiter, so
yeah. Nice.
But you were very interested in looking out. We do have Linux jobs. Actually, there are actually a lot of Linux jobs.
Now, are you aware of our jobs list, our announced list?
No, I'm not actually.
Okay, well, you're welcome to post Linux and open source related jobs to it, and I can give you the email address.
slug-jobs-announce@slug.org.
No, we have a separate list for mailings for jobs, and it's, you know, fairly active. Smith Johnson posts jobs there and a few others. Yeah, and I think it's because of cost. Companies are looking to say, what can we do that'll save us money and licensing fees or whatever, and Linux and open source tends to be a good answer for a lot of that.
The margins are kind of so thin that no one can expect for commodity devices. No one can afford the Microsoft license.
Yeah.
And the current job I'm at, they had a contractor, and they just couldn't afford it. A lot less expensive apparently than the contractor. And so we hired people to do that. So,
cool.
I guess the trick is to become a contractor.
Well, yeah, the contractor part is the like where you make a lot of money, but you have to work for it. So, and if you don't, like, because the contractor guy said he had tons of work and was like, I have so much work I can't keep up, so it's okay. I have the money. So, and I actually know him, so it's kind of cool.
So.
Mm-hmm.
So, Daniel, do you do mostly tech related?
Jobs out there, you know, if you're interested.
Cool.
Leave my card here.
Okay. Yeah, if you want to bring them up here, we can just have people grab them after the meeting. Wrap them off. Yeah, especially in the economy coming up, there may be a few of us looking for jobs.
Yeah, that's
so, at some point. We can just put up here.
You said something about Universal on 33rd.
Yeah, there's Universal Systems on 33rd.
Well, they have moved. They're
they moved down the street.
Well, 39th and what?
It's just up from 7th, isn't it?
It's somewhere between 7th and State. I'm not sure.
Or
I really
just up from 9th. They might be just up from 9th. Anyway, yeah, it's a smaller building, but, well, it's a less height one.
How long ago did they move?
About a year,
last
I think.
Last fall, somewhere in there.
Oh, okay.
I didn't ever see any announcements. You just drove by once.
They usually have pretty good prices. They actually sponsored Slug for years and years and years by hosting our web server for over a decade, I think. They're just really good guys. They helped build the clusters up here at the U, supplied most of the hardware for a lot of the clusters here.
They do more mid-range systems.
Yeah. And they're really good for service, too. It's been my experience, at least.
Question.
Yeah.
Anything new happening with Utopia, or is it dead?
Well, it's still going on. I don't see them talking about it. But
any hope it'll ever expand anymore?
I don't know.
Because the rest of what's out there is just junk.
Yeah.
Most of the cities don't want to underwrite it. Anybody that's not already into it is not going to underwrite it. They're going to.
Especially with the economy the way it is, they probably
got talked out of taking part in it in the first place by outfits like Quest and so forth that thought they were going to come in and cut a big fat hog. And quite frankly, you know, I can't get high-speed Quest. I can't get an awful lot of stuff at my place. Yeah. Sprint broadband sucks.
Then you have the Sprint microwave broadband, or...
I used to have the Sprint microwave broadband until they lost the band. It doesn't exist anymore, so I've got this stupid little modem thing that, on a good day, I can get about 40 kilobytes per second.
I've gone to Utah Broadband as a replacement for Sprint when they pulled out, and it seems to be pretty comparable, microwave again.
Utah Broadband?
Yeah, Utah Broadband. They were actually acquired by somebody else, and I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head. But if you do a Google on Utah Broadband, it'll turn up.
Is it Radioverse?
Or whatever
it's called?
Oh, no.
There's a couple companies that got acquired by them. So.
Apparently, there was a hack released recently for BlackBerry. If you have a BlackBerry device on Verizon or some other provider, you can actually use it as a modem for...
You can tether with your Bluetooth.
Yeah.
You've been able to do that with Palms.
Yeah, so you could hijack your unlimited data plan and.
And you can do it with the iPhone now.
Today there was some credit card pairing company announced they had a compromise of about in hundreds of millions of credit card holders.
when did that happen? Just recently.
It happened in December.
Oh, it happened. Yeah, I think I just read that.
Okay.
Yeah, it makes you wonder. Yeah, let's see.
Does anybody have any experience with Linksys G3 routers?
The 3G routers?
See,
they work pretty well, but I've used quite a few of them.
Oh, this thing that I've got basically gives up the ghost. You just run a while and just quit.
Is it one of those ones that you put the card in it?
Yeah. POS.
The ones that we were using, I'm guessing they were newer ones, but they're the Linksys ones, and they work pretty well. just put a 3G card in, it doesn't matter what brand it is.
Well, this is brand specific, and it doesn't like Sprint.
I mean, all so I've used the Sprint one, and I've used T-Mobile and Verizon on a different location.
I'll talk to you after we're done here, because yeah. It's...
Well, I mean, it's just, you know, the experience is it just works. I mean, it's okay. Not... I don't ever own one. I just use them. So okay. I'm not sure how I could help, but they were just the little routers, and then they were wireless, and then
you yeah, put
the card at the top.
It's got all that set of runs for a while, and then eventually gets so it won't even boot and access the
motor. Try to get it through.
What's that?
Oh, it's not coming through.
He's trying to find that link now. Did you know that Paris Hilton's site got hacked?
What a shame.
What did they do?
So it turns out they were playing with an open source software. I can't remember if it was Drupal or something. It turns out somebody had programmed an iframe that had something else in it, and that was what actually got them access to the server. So it wasn't the open source CMS that did it, but they had to like retract their statement and apologize.
Mark, I think that business was going to have something about Seagate in it.
Science Tech did.
They back the site and take all the porn off of it.
Very, very knowledgeable as far as recording equipment, things like that, home theater stuff, and so Gilbert Performance Audio is one of the
They're on Maine and.
Right around there. He knows absolutely everything about audio visual equipment.
They've got a lot of my money over the years.
Yeah, I know.
What's that thing? It's just a fun thing to play with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This kind of stuff, he's the best, sales person, helpful person.
The fun thing is, my home audio system is in a full height rack mount. I said, well, if I've got a rack mount, I got to get rack mount components. I mean, come on.
Like that, so.
Well, yeah, I have a picture of my server somewhere.
Yeah,
it's pretty funny.
Make sure you GPS tag it for us and put it up on.
Yeah. Yeah, Yeah, I got a full height rack for $100 here. So it was a nice deal. Well, let's go ahead and have the drawing.
The one about the hack, I think there was a note that they were going to notify the people who got compromised in the states that mandated it.
Uh-huh.
So is there enough Utah mandates that?
I don't know.
Yeah, not that mandates it, but a bank that we had an account with got hacked or they lost a laptop or something. And they did the right thing.
Yeah. And the U, when they had their medical records hacked, they contacted people too. But
it sounded like these guys were only going to do it where it was legally required.
Some companies are such weasels. I mean, they don't do the morally right thing just because they don't have to. Well, okay, so the giveaway is a boxed edition of 11.1. And then we also have the non-boxed versions that you can just come up and take. And we have Fedora Core. Wait.
10.
Core 10?
They don't call it Core anymore.
Just Fedora 10?
Yeah.
Here also. So we have about 15 or 20 of each of these, so you can come up and grab one. We won't draw for those. But we'll only draw for these, for this one. So since we only have, I have two, but we're going to save the next one for next month. So we have something to give away. Yeah, we're going to give one away this month. So one lucky person will walk away with a box edition. This contains the manuals and the DVD for all architectures and the non-open source software as well, so it's a pretty good deal. Has anybody played with 11.1 yet? It's pretty cool. We've been playing with it here tonight, but looks like every other distro. You know, I'm not sure. It may.
233.
That would be me.
Really?
Yeah.
All right.
I was like, well, I'm going to try it out anyway, so that's a perfect chance.
There you go. And everybody else can just come up and get a DVD anyway. So
that's it?
Yep, that's it.
Vanna's done?
Yeah, it's done. Thanks, Vanna. So I'm going to grab one of the Fedora ones so I can play with it.
Yeah, it's the license you can try it out.
Okay. So there's... Come up and get a card from Derek.
Thank you for listening to Hacker Public Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.